pictures to come along. When the group showed up, the old man immediately handed a £5 note to each of the teenagers and explained that he was happy to pay them to shout abuse. Bemused, the teenagers took the money and came out with their usual rude remarks. The old man repeated his actions each day for a week. The following week was slightly different. When the teenagers came along, the old man explained that he had had a tough week financially and so could pay each of them only £1. Unperturbed, the teenagers continued to take his money and persisted with their childish chants. At the start of the third week, everything changed again. When the group arrived, the old man explained that it had been another tough week, and now he could afford to pay the teenagers only 20 pence each. Insulted at the small amount of money on offer, the teenagers refused to shout their abuse. The story is almost certainly apocryphal, but it reflects a fundamental truth about why we do what we do. To fully understand the wisdom behind the old man's actions, we need to travel back to the 1970s and discover what happened when a group of people were paid to solve a wooden puzzle. Psychiatrist Edward Deci was a big fan of a commercially available puzzle called Soma. The puzzle involved giving people several oddly shaped wooden blocks and asking them to arrange the blocks into specified shapes. Deci wondered if the puzzle could be used to discover whether the as-if principle influences motivation. Deci invited volunteers into his laboratory and asked them to play with the puzzle for 30 minutes. Before starting, some of the volunteers were told that if they could solve the puzzle, they would be given a financial reward. The others weren't offered any incentive. After 30 minutes, Deci told all the participants that their quality time with Soma was up. He then explained that he had left the paperwork needed for the next part of the experiment in his office and so had to leave the laboratory to fetch it. As is so often the case with social psychology experiments, this "I have to leave the laboratory now" ploy was a cover story. The important part of the experiment was just about to take place. Deci left each participant alone for 10 minutes. During this time, they were free to continue to play Soma or read the magazines that had been strategically placed on a nearby table, or indeed neither. All of the time, Deci was secretly observing their behavior. Conventional pigeon-based reward theory predicts that those who had been paid to play Soma would have found the puzzle especially enjoyable, and so be more likely to continue with it when Deci left the laboratory. In contrast, the as-if principle makes a quite different set of predictions. According to the as-if principle, the participants who were offered the financial reward to play with the puzzle would have unconsciously thought, "People offer me money only when they want me to do something that I don't want to do. I was offered money to play with the puzzle, so it can't be much fun." Using the same logic, those who weren't offered any financial incentive would have unconsciously thought, "People offer me money only when they want me to do something that I don't want to do. I wasn't offered any money to play with the puzzle, so it must be fun." Seen in this way, those who had been offered the reward had been made to behave as if they didn't actually enjoy playing with the puzzle, whereas those who hadn't been offered any financial incentive were behaving as if playing with the puzzle was fun. According to the as-if principle, Deci's payments would have turned play into hard work, and so the participants who were financially rewarded would be significantly more likely to leave the puzzle alone when he left the room. Deci's results provided overwhelming support for the power of acting as if. Regardless of participants' success at completing the puzzle, those who had not been previously offered the financial reward were far more likely to play with the puzzle when left to their own devices. Other researchers quickly conducted several similar experiments to discover whether this intriguing finding was genuine. In perhaps the best known of these studies, Stanford psychologist Mark Lepper and colleagues visited several schools and asked schoolchildren to draw some pictures. Before being allowed access to the crayons and paper, Lepper told one group of children that they would receive a good player medal for drawing. A second group of children was not given the promise of any reward. According to the as-if principle, the children who are offered the medal would have unconsciously thought, I am offered rewards only when adults want me to do something that I don't enjoy. I am being offered a gold medal for drawing. Therefore, I must not like drawing. Similarly, the children in the other group would have thought, I am offered rewards only when adults want me to do something that I don't enjoy. I am not being offered any reward for drawing. Therefore, I must like drawing. A few weeks later, Lepa and the teams returned to the school, handed out the drawing materials again, and measured how much the children played with them. The children who had received the medals a few weeks before spent significantly less time drawing than their classmates did. The message from the studies is clear. Rewarding the behaviour of schoolchildren, smokers and drivers encourages them to behave as if they don't really want to read books, stop smoking or buckle up. As a result, the moment the rewards are removed, the desired behaviour runs the risk of grinding to a sudden halt or, worse, becomes even less frequent than before incentives were introduced. In the short term, reward systems can be effective. However, over the long haul, most organizations struggle to maintain a continuous supply of special privileges, candy, gifts, and bonuses, and the moment the rewards stop, people's motivation often vanishes into thin air. The man with X-ray eyes. Having established the as-if principle plays a key role in motivation, researchers began to explore other ways in which the effect could be used to encourage people to spring into action. In the workplace, some business gurus argued for the importance of reconfiguring jobs to make them more intrinsically enjoyable by giving employees a greater sense of autonomy, purpose, and fun. When it came to people's personal lives, some psychologists turned their attention to role play. Consider, for example, the work of Leon Mann from Harvard University and his groundbreaking study into giving up smoking. Mann invited 26 very heavy smokers to his laboratory and randomly split them into two groups. Those in one group were asked to behave as if they were going to give up smoking by role-playing someone who had been diagnosed with cancer. To make the pretense as realistic as possible, Mann created a fake doctor's office at the university. When the participants entered the room, they saw a variety of medical equipment and an actor wearing a white coat. The actor played the role of a doctor and brought out the participants' alleged X-rays. It wasn't good news. According to a set of fictitious medical records, the participant had lung cancer. The participant was asked to respond by discussing how he or she now intended to give up smoking. In contrast, the participants in the control group were shown the same highly emotional information about having lung cancer, but were not asked to alter their behavior by taking part in any form of role play. The results were remarkable. At the start of the study, all of the participants were smoking around 25 cigarettes a day. Immediately after the experiment, those in the control group cut down by an average of 5 cigarettes per day, whereas those who had been involved in the role play showed an average reduction of 10 cigarettes per day. Acting as if they were going to reduce the amount they smoked caused a significant change in the participants' actual behavior. The researchers then tracked the participants over the next few years and discovered that the effect was not short-lived. 2 years after taking part in the study, those who'd been involved in the role-playing were still smoking significantly less than those in the control group. When they weren't injecting meaning in the workplace or role-play in people's personal lives, psychologists were busy discovering that a little often goes a surprisingly long way. 2. Why small changes have a big impact. Let's imagine that you are at home and hear a knock on the door. You peek through your curtains and see a young man standing on your doorstep. He looks harmless enough, and so you decide to answer the door. The man explains that he is a volunteer working for an organization that supports research into cancer and wonders whether you would make a donation. You think about it and then decide that it is better to give than take, and so you give a small amount of money to him. This may seem like an innocent encounter. In reality, you may have just taken part in a psychology experiment. This type of "would you mind contributing to charity" study was first carried out by Patricia Pliner from the University of Toronto and demonstrated how the as-if principle could be used to get people to spring into action. Pliner's results showed that 46% of residents were prepared to write a check to the cancer charity. In the next stage of Pliner's experiment, the researchers had the volunteers approach a second set of houses and asked the residents to wear a lapel pin to help publicize their cause. The pin was small, and almost all of the residents agreed. 2 weeks later, the volunteers returned to these pin-wearing residents and asked for a financial donation. Amazingly, over 90% of the residents agreed to give to the charity. Known as the foot-in-the-door technique, this approach works because the small initial request caused the residents to behave as if they were the type of people who give to charity. This encourages them to believe that they are altruistic individuals, and so motivates them to agree to the much larger request. More than 40 years of research have shown that the technique works in many different situations. Some of the most interesting and practical work has been conducted by French researcher Nicolas Guégan. In one study, Guégan travelled to Brittany and randomly split some of the residents into two groups. Guégan then telephoned the residents in one of the groups, pretended that he was from a local energy firm, and asked them to take part in a short telephone survey about energy conservation. A few days later, Guégan sent out a letter to all of the residents in his experiment. The letter came from the mayor of the town and asked people to participate in an energy conservation program. More than 50% of those who had been asked to take part in the telephone survey agreed to participate, compared with just 20% of those who hadn't been previously contacted. In another study, Guégan emailed more than 1,000 people and asked them to visit a website that had been set up to support children who had been the victims of war. When half of the people visited the website, they saw a message inviting them to click another link if they wanted to make a contribution to the charity. In contrast, when the others came to the website, they were asked to sign a petition against landmines and then asked to click a link if they wished to make a financial contribution to the charity. Only 3% of those who weren't asked to sign the petition clicked the donation link, versus nearly 14% of those who had signed the petition. Finally, Guégan has also used this foot-in-the-door phenomenon to help Cupid find his target. Venturing out onto the streets, Guégan arranged for experimenters to approach more than 300 young women and ask them out for a drink. Sometimes the experimenter asked for directions or a light for a cigarette before popping the question. Other times they took a more direct approach and asked the woman about the possibility of a drink straight away. This small change made a big difference, with 60% of those who had been asked directions first saying yes to the drink, versus just 20% of those who had been asked directly. In each instance, people had seen themselves acting as if they were pro-energy conservation, anti-war, or up for a drink, and so became motivated to act in a way that was consistent with their newly found identity. Salespeople often turn to this powerful principle. Behavioral expert Robert Cialdini refers to it as the lowball technique. It involves a set of procedures designed to get people to behave as if they are interested in a certain product or service. For example, a car showroom may advertise a vehicle at a very reasonable price in order to lure potential customers into the showroom. It is only when they have inquired about a car, and therefore behaved as if they are interested in buying it, that the salesman explains about the various extra add-ons that will increase the price of the vehicle. Similarly, hotels may place online advertisements offering rooms at a low price. Once a potential customer has clicked on the ad and so behaved as if he or she is going to make a reservation, the traveler discovers that the bargain rooms have all been sold, but some higher-priced rooms are still available. 20 Pieces, Part 2. Just before the start of this chapter, I asked you to complete Part 1 of the 20 Pieces exercise. This exercise is all about procrastination. I pointed out that it was a fairly boring task and that you didn't have to do the tearing there and then. Did you complete the exercise? If so, you are probably the type of person who doesn't have much of a problem motivating yourself when the going gets tough. However, if you decided to leave the tearing until later, then you are more likely to suffer from procrastination. The ability to procrastinate often stops people from doing well in many aspects of their lives and makes them feel tired and lacking in control. Or, as William James put it, nothing is so fatiguing as the eternal hanging on of an uncompleted task. If you do fall into the latter camp, then worry not. The as-if principle can help. Simply go back to the exercise, pick up a piece of letter-sized paper, no need to rip it into 20 pieces just now, and then listen to the following paragraph. How do you feel about completing the rest of the exercise now? According to research, at this moment you will be experiencing a strange urge to finish the job by ripping the page into 20 pieces. By working on an activity for just a few minutes, that is, behaving as if you are a highly motivated person, you change the way you see yourself and make it far more likely that you will complete whatever it is you have to do. Whenever you have a mountain to climb, persuade yourself to spend just a few minutes taking those all-important first few steps. The principle can also cause people to radically change their behavior for the worse. In the early 1970s, for instance, the military junta in Greece wanted to train ordinary soldiers to become sadistic torturers. Using the foot-in-the-door technique, they slowly persuaded these soldiers to abuse prisoners. At the start of the process, the soldiers were asked to stand outside cells while prisoners were tortured. In the next stage of the process, they were invited to come into the cells and witness the abuse. Then the soldiers were asked to provide a small amount of assistance inside the cells, perhaps holding the prisoner down as he was beaten. Finally, they were asked to carry out the beatings themselves, and so became the next generation of torturers as the newest recruits stood outside the cells. Slowly but surely, the foot-in-the-door technique motivated the soldiers to carry out actions that they would have originally considered completely unacceptable. On a more positive note, some of the most recent research into the foot-in-the-door technique has explored whether the smallest of commitments can help make the world a better place. Americans generate more than 150 million tons of trash every year, enough to fill the New Orleans Superdome twice every day. Psychologist Sean Byrne from the California Polytechnic State University decided to discover whether the foot-in-the-door technique might be able to promote recycling. Byrne's experiment involved five separate areas in Claremont, a small affluent college town in eastern Los Angeles County. Just before the start of the experiment, Byrne and his colleagues secretly observed the recycling activity of the residents, identified about 200 households that didn't recycle, and set out to see if they could change the residents' behavior. Byrne started off by enrolling the help of a local troop of Boy Scouts and spent 3 weeks training them for the study. First, he had the Scouts rehearse reading aloud a carefully created message stressing the need for recycling. Next, the investigators played the role of Claremont residents and asked the Scouts to knock on their imaginary door and deliver the well-rehearsed message. When the investigators were convinced that their highly trained Scouts were ready for the job, they were let loose on the public. The Scouts were put into groups of three. The investigators took each group to Claremont and asked the groups to knock on the door of an unsuspecting participant. When the door opened, the Scouts would launch into their carefully prepared speech about the importance of recycling. A few moments later, they would hand the resident a pledge card and a sticker. The pledge card simply said, "I, blank, pledge support for Claremont's recycling program. I will help win the war on waste." The sticker was equally straightforward and carried the message, "I recycle to win the war on waste." For the next 6 weeks, the research team again took to the streets and secretly observed the recycling behavior of the residents. The results were remarkable. Those who had not been visited showed only a 3% increase in recycling. In contrast, asking people to sign a pledge card and put a sticker up in their house resulted in a 20% shift. Just spending a few moments behaving as if they intended to recycle had a dramatic impact on their subsequent motivation to go green. Change for life. In 2011, I teamed up with the British government to help promote a campaign that used the foot-in-the-door technique to encourage the public to lead healthier lives. The work, part of a national campaign known as Change for Life, sought to encourage people to make small alterations to their diet and level of exercise in the hope that these would then lead to more significant changes. In part of the work, we asked people to change their behaviour whenever they encountered any of the following 10 triggers. Try incorporating them into your life and see if they act as a catalyst for more significant changes. When you find yourself reaching for some sweets, chocolate or potato chips, stop and instead go for some fresh fruit, such as grapes, a banana or raisins, rice cakes or unsalted nuts. When you're thinking about frying something, grill it instead. Try grilling your bacon and sausages and scrambling or poaching your eggs. When you're just about to order a large glass of white wine, change it for a spritzer made with a smaller amount of wine and sparkling water. When you're out and about and just about to take the elevator or escalator, look around for some stairs and, if possible, use them instead. If you're using public transport, see whether you can get off one stop too soon and walk the rest of the way. When you're cooking for you or your family and are about to serve up the food on a full-size plate, swap the plate for a smaller one. It will encourage you to serve more modest portions. When you're just about to put sugar into your tea or coffee, put in only half the amount of sugar. When you are in a store and about to buy some white bread or white rice, boost the amount of fiber in your diet by choosing whole wheat bread and brown rice. When you're about to order a sugary soda, change your mind and go for sparkling water, milk, or pure fruit juice. Instead of ordering a large main course, go for a smaller portion with a side order of salad or vegetables. 3. Losing weight without trying. Levels of obesity are rising across the world. In the mid-1980s, 15% of Americans were considered obese. By 2003, this had risen to around 34%, with a staggering 17% of American children and adolescents classified as overweight. Carrying too much weight increases the likelihood of various health problems, especially heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and certain forms of cancer. It therefore isn't surprising that millions of people make a concerted attempt to lose weight at some point in their lives. Ironically, the chances that they will be successful are slim. Many people are attracted to the quick and easy results promised by proponents of very low-calorie diets. Such diets are usually based around low-calorie, nutritionally complete, liquid meals. The short-term impact of such diets is impressive. Several research studies suggest that around half of those using these products quickly lose around 80% of their excess weight. However, when the researchers followed the dieters for the next few years, a very different picture emerged. After about 3 years, most of the participants had returned to their pre-diet weight, and after 5 years, only 3% remained slim. This depressing pattern of results is not limited to very low-calorie diets. After examining the results from hundreds of studies involving many different types of diets, one reviewer noted, "It is only the rate of weight regain, not the fact of weight regain, that appears open to debate." Other work that has tried to promote weight loss through physical exercise has faced similar problems. In 2008, researcher Larry Weber from Tulane University and his colleagues reported the results from a large-scale study examining whether it was possible to encourage physical exercise in middle school children. The two-year experiment encompassed 36 schools and thousands of children in the United States. In half of the schools, the researchers did everything they could to encourage exercise and weight loss. Each week, the children were told about the importance of physical activity and asked to carry out a specified amount of exercise. The researchers even encouraged the schools to team up with local health clubs and recreation centers and stage special dance classes, gym sessions, and basketball matches. In contrast, the children in the other schools acted as a control and so weren't subjected to such opportunities and encouragement. To discover the effect of the program, the researchers fit all children with an accelerometer to measure their movements and also track their body mass index. What impact did the extensive program of encouragement have? Almost zilch. The children who were given the opportunity to play more sports and encouraged to exercise ended up moving around very slightly more than those in the control group. Perhaps more important, there was no difference in the average body mass index between the two groups. Why? The study was based on the notion that changing minds causes people to change their behavior. According to this approach, all you have to do is tell people about the importance of a healthy diet and regular exercise, and they will immediately jump into action. However, this approach has been shown to be flawed. Instead, an understanding of the as-if principle provides a far more effective technique for long-term weight loss. Pull me, push you. If you are sitting at a table, try this quick two-part exercise. First, take a book, put it down on the table, and push it away from you. Second, pull the book toward you, pick it up, and give it a little hug and a kiss. If you are doing this in a bookshop or another public place, you might want to smile at those around you in a "it's okay, I'm not dangerous" kind of a way. How did you feel about the book after each part of the exercise? Research suggests that pushing an object away from you, behaving as if you don't like it, makes you dislike the object, whereas pulling it toward you, behaving as if you like it, makes you feel far more positively about it. As far as I am aware, no previous research has examined the impact of hugging and kissing an object, but I am assuming that that makes you feel especially attached to the book. Next time you are confronted with a plate of high-calorie snacks or chocolate chip cookies, simply push the plate away from you and feel the temptation fade. Similarly, if you are in the sales game and want to make a client feel more positive about a product, place it on a table in front of this client and encourage her to slide it toward herself. Eating with your eyes. Chapter 2 looked at the pioneering work of psychologist Stanley Schachter that revealed a surprising relationship between the as-if principle and attraction. In the 1960s, Schachter also came up with a similarly daring hypothesis to explain why some people are obese. According to Schachter, people start eating on the basis of two very different types of signals. The first set of signals comes from within your body. For example, after you've just consumed a large meal, your stomach might send you an "okay, I couldn't even manage a wafer-thin mint" message, and so you know that it is time to stop eating. Or maybe you feel your tummy rumble, experience a sudden drop in blood sugar, and know that you should head to the kitchen. Conceptually, eating because you feel hungry is like feeling happy because you're smiling. In both instances, you decide how you're feeling on the basis of what your body is telling you. Alternatively, your decision to eat might be influenced by signals from your surroundings. You might, for instance, see a great-looking cake in a bakery window and decide that it has your name written all over it. Or you might glance at your watch, see that it is time for a snack, and head for the kitchen. In these instances, you are ignoring the signals from your body and instead deciding how you should feel on the basis of what is happening around you. Although everyone is influenced by both sets of signals, Schachter speculated that some people are more likely to listen to their body, Schachter referred to them as internals, while others are more likely to be affected by their surroundings, externals. He also hypothesized that when provisions are scarce, neither group will become obese, as internals will eat just when they are hungry, and externals will munch away on the rare occasions that they have access to food. So far, so good. However, in most developed countries, the supermarket aisles are jammed full of junk food. Fast food chains encourage people to supersize, and movies offer huge buckets of popcorn with calorie-filled butter. According to Schachter's theory, this excess of food will not present a problem to internals. They will continue to listen to their bodies and munch away when they are hungry. In contrast, the externals now have a problem. To them, each of the food mountains that they encounter on a daily basis screams out, "Eat me!" Unless these people can exercise an extraordinary amount of self-control, they will soon find themselves consuming everything in sight. As a result, Schachter predicted that in most of the developed world, internals will tend to be on the slim side, while externals will tend to be overweight. It is an elegant and clever theory, but is it correct? To help find out, Richard Nisbet from Yale University conducted an ingenious experiment. He recruited a mixture of slim and overweight people and invited them to his laboratory, one at a time. All of the participants were asked to arrive in the early afternoon and not to eat after 9 o'clock in the morning. After taking part in a boring experiment, can you count back from 1,000 in threes? Each of the participants was rewarded with some sandwiches. In reality, the tedious experiment was completely irrelevant. The core of Nisbet's experiment was to secretly observe the participants after they had been given the sandwiches, thus scientifically proving that there really is no such thing as a free lunch. Each participant was presented with a plate containing either one or three tasty roast beef sandwiches and told that they were free to help themselves to more sandwiches in a nearby refrigerator. Schachter's theory predicted that the slim participants would be internals, and so the amount of food they consumed would not be related to the number of sandwiches on the plate. If they felt hungry, they would start to consume the sandwiches, and they would stop eating the moment they felt that their stomachs were full. In contrast, the overweight participants would tend to be externals, who were driven by their eyes, and so would eat far more when they were presented with the three sandwiches. Obviously, it was possible that the overweight participants felt hungrier than their slimmer counterparts. To allow for this, the experimenters made an intriguing prediction. Following the out-of-sight, out-of-mind maxim, they predicted that the overweight participants wouldn't be any more likely than the slim subjects to raid the refrigerator. What happened? When both groups of participants were presented with one sandwich, they ate the same amount. However, when they were presented with three sandwiches, the overweight participants quickly gobbled down far more than their slim counterparts. Not only that, both the slim and overweight participants were equally unlikely to raid the refrigerator. In another cleverly designed study, Ronald Goldman and his colleagues from Columbia University made good use of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is one of the most sacred of the Jewish holy days, with those adhering to the Jewish faith undergoing 24 hours without food or water. Goldman knew that modern Jewish people vary in the degree to which they observe this tradition, with some spending almost all of Yom Kippur in the synagogue, and others going there for only an hour or so. Goldman speculated that those who spent lots of time in the synagogue would not be constantly reminded about food. In his paper describing the work, Goldman noted that the main food-related reference during the religious rituals at Yom Kippur would be a passing mention of a scapegoat. On the basis of Schachter's theory, Goldman speculated that slim people would be relying on their bodies to tell them whether they were hungry, and so feel the same amount of food-deprived discomfort, regardless of the amount of time that they spent at the synagogue. In contrast, overweight people would be relying on their surroundings to tell them whether they should eat, and so feel significantly more comfortable at the synagogue. To find out if this was the case, Goldman sent around a questionnaire to his Jewish students, asking them for their height, weight, how many hours they spent at a synagogue during Yom Kippur, and how difficult they found fasting. The results from the slim students revealed no relationship between the number of hours they spent at the synagogue and how difficult they found the fasting. In contrast, the longer the overweight students spent away from the synagogue during Yom Kippur, the more difficult they found fasting, exactly as Schachter had predicted. Schachter's theory has huge implications for restaurants wanting to sell more food and people wanting to diet. From a restaurateur's point of view, persuading customers to become less self-conscious and so ignore the signals from their stomach is good for business. For example, low lighting and soft music help focus people's attention away from themselves and also encourage diners to eat more. Similarly, tempting externals with photographs of food, or indeed the real thing, is also good for business. Research shows that placing alluring images of delicious-looking dishes on a menu or wheeling in the dessert trolley at the end of a meal will tempt even the most self-controlled of externals. In one study, researchers asked the staff at a French restaurant to classify their diners as either chubby or normal weight. At the end of the meal, a server approached tables with a pie in hand and asked who would like dessert. Both the normal and overweight diners were equally likely to order dessert, but the overweight people showed a strong tendency to go for the pie that was sitting right in front of their eyes. If you do want to lose weight, Schachter's theory can help. Try to get in touch with your inner internal by focusing more attention on what your body is trying to tell you. Just before you order that cake, for example, ask yourself, "Am I really hungry?" Similarly, reduce the tempting sights that are leading you astray by keeping unhealthy food out of sight and staying away from supermarket aisles packed with snacks and cookies. Also, try to avoid situations that involve eating food and distracting your attention away from yourself. Don't watch television, listen to music, or even read while you are eating. Instead, focus your attention on the food itself and slowly chew each mouthful. If that fails, try to make mealtimes as self-conscious as possible by eating in front of a mirror, replacing your knife and fork with chopsticks, or vice versa, or using your non-dominant hand. Schachter's simple theory links the as-if principle with eating. Slim people are basing their decision about whether to eat on the signals from their bodies. In the same way that people feel happy when their face forms a smile, so they eat when their stomach tells them that they are hungry. In contrast, people who are overweight tend not to base their decisions about eating on the signals from their body and are instead more influenced by external signals. By getting them to refocus on behaving more in line with the as-if principle, they can quickly shed any unwanted pounds. Dieting does not have to involve struggling in vain to overcome temptation. Instead, it is a question of listening to what your body is telling you. Monitoring yourself. Take a look at your computer monitor. Is the center of the monitor above, below, or level with your eye line? According to research exploring the as-if principle and motivation, the position of your monitor could be having a significant effect on your productivity. In the 1980s, John Riskin from Texas A&M University decided to examine the effect of posture on persistence. He placed participants in one of two positions. Half of the participants were placed in a slumped position, such that their backs were stooped and hunched over and heads dropped down. In contrast, the other participants were made to sit upright, with their shoulders pulled back and heads held high. After sitting stooped or upright for about 3 minutes, participants were sent to another room and asked to try to solve several geometric puzzles that involved tracing over a diagram without lifting their pencil off the page. In fact, many of the puzzles were impossible to solve. Riskin was interested only in how long the participants kept going in the face of failure. Describing his findings in a paper entitled they stoop to conquer. Riskin noted how the participants who had previously been sitting up straight persevered for almost twice as long as the slouchers. More recently, other psychologists built on this work by asking participants to sit at a computer and work on a complex problem. Some of the time the computer monitor was placed in a low position, causing participants to slump down. Other times it was placed slightly above their eyeline, causing participants to sit up straight. Once again, those with their head held high persevered for longer. To ensure maximum motivation, place the center of your monitor slightly above your eyeline. Creatures of Habit. Schachter's theory is not the only work linking the as-if principle and eating. I've worked at the University of Hertfordshire for many years. Throughout my time there, I've been fortunate enough to have brushed shoulders with many energetic and creative colleagues. Professor Ben Fletcher is one of those people. Despite nearly always dressing in black, Ben is a happy man who shares my passion for quirky psychology that is relevant to everyday life. Ben's background is in business psychology, and much of his early work examines stress in the workplace. While he was carrying out this research, he discovered the downside of being a creature of habit. Some people think and behave in highly inflexible ways. They might, for example, always try to solve problems using the same type of solutions, hold meetings in highly formulaic ways, and find comfort in the certainty that comes with their daily routines. In contrast, others embrace the unpredictable, enjoy lateral thinking, and are open to new ideas. Ben speculated that people who struggle to be flexible might be fine when they're working in an environment that is highly stable, but struggle when faced with the need to change and adapt. To find out if his hunch was correct, Ben created a questionnaire to measure a person's level of flexibility. Do you sometimes behave in a way that your colleagues consider unconventional? Do you get bothered when people change plans at the last minute? You enjoy being presented with questions followed by a limited range of options, true or false. Footnote: I made up the last one. End footnote. Ben then went to several different types of companies and asked the employees there to complete the questionnaire, rate how well they coped with change, and indicate how anxious they felt. The results revealed that inflexible people did indeed find change difficult, tended not to enjoy their jobs, and were especially anxious. Ben then wondered whether the same concept also applied to people's lives outside their workplace. He speculated that many of the problems that people have in life are caused by their being inflexible and tied to certain habits. Overweight people are in the habit of eating too much and exercising too little. Smokers habitually reach into their pocket and pull out cigarettes. Many of those struggling to find a new relationship are in the habit of going to the same sorts of places and chatting to the same sorts of people. What would happen, wondered Ben, if these people were encouraged to behave as if they were not creatures of habit? Muscle magic. People who are highly motivated often tense their muscles as they get ready to spring into action. But is the opposite also true? Can you boost your willpower by tensing your muscles? Rhys Hung from the National University of Singapore and his colleague decided to find out. Hung assembled several groups of participants and asked them to keep their hands submerged in an ice bucket for as long as possible, consume a healthy but terrible-tasting vinegar drink, or visit a local cafeteria and buy healthy food rather than sugary snacks. Each time, half of the participants were asked to tighten certain muscles by making their hand into a fist, sitting down and lifting their heels off the floor, holding a pen by tightly weaving it between their fingers, or contracting their bicep. Each of these exercises was designed to make the participants behave as if they were trying hard to exert self-control. The results showed that those carrying out the exercises were more likely to keep their hand in the bucket of ice for longer, down more vinegar, or buy healthier food. Next time you feel your willpower draining away, try to tense a muscle. Consider, for example, making a fist, contracting your bicep, pressing your thumb and first finger together, or gripping a pen in your hand. If all else fails, try crossing your arms. Another study, this one conducted by Ron Friedman and Andrew Elliott from the University of Rochester in New York, involved asking people to tackle difficult anagrams with either their arms crossed or resting on their thighs. By folding their arms, people were acting as if they were persistent. The volunteers with their arms folded continued to persevere for nearly twice as long as those with their hands on their thighs. To find out what happens when people are encouraged to alter their habits, Ben teamed up with another university colleague, Karen Pine, and together they developed a technique known as Do Something Different, DSD. DSD consists of a series of exercises that encourages people to behave as if they have a flexible approach to life. They might, for example, be asked to stop watching television for a day, pen a poem, get in touch with an old friend, or travel to work using different routes. Over the years, Ben and Karen have monitored the effects of these simple techniques on many different areas of people's lives. Take, for example, Ben and Karen's work on weight loss. In several studies, they recruited people who wanted to lose weight and randomly allocated them to different groups. One of the groups was encouraged to carry out the DSD techniques for a month. These participants were not told to eat a healthier diet or get more exercise. Instead, they were encouraged to vary their ways of thinking and behaving, such as going to bed an hour earlier or turning off their cell phones for a day. In contrast, some of the other groups were either not given any instructions or followed a diet of their choosing. After tracking the groups over several months, the results suggest that DSD helps people lose weight. Similar research has shown that the same technique can also help people stop smoking and increase their chances of finding a job. Many undesirable behaviors, such as smoking and overeating, are the result of people behaving as if they are creatures of habit. By getting them to behave in a far more flexible fashion, they begin to see themselves in a completely different way. Suddenly, they are no longer someone who just mindlessly repeats old behavioral patterns, but rather someone who is able to take control of his or her life and respond to the surroundings. It may seem like magic to this person. In reality, it is another example of the as-if principle at work. The as-if principle provides a new and exciting way of looking at the thorny issue of motivation. It explains why rewards often fail and, more important, provides the basis for several motivational tools that are both quick to implement and highly effective. If you carry out the smallest of commitments, you are far more likely to engage with much bigger changes. Cross your arms, tense your muscles, and sit up straight, and you will persevere longer when the going gets tough. Behave as if you are no longer a creature of habit, and suddenly you'll find it much easier to give up smoking and lose weight. These simple and quick techniques encourage you to change one small aspect of your behavior. In doing so, the as-if principle springs into action and makes you feel like a new and far more motivated person. Chapter 5. Persuasion, where we explore the problems of changing people's minds, find out what really manipulates the masses, and discover how cooperation can shape society. How can I tell what I think till I see what I say? E.M. Forster, Aspects of the Novel. 1. The Problems of Persuasion. The Korean War saw two major conflicts. The first involved American and other pro-democracy forces fighting fierce battles with communist troops drawn from China and North Korea. The second was fought behind the barbed wire fences of North Koreans' prisoner of war camps and was a battle for the hearts and minds of American service personnel captured during the fighting. Hostilities officially came to an end in July 1953, with both sides agreeing to divide Korea into two separate countries. In January the following year, the prisoner of war camps were shut down, and the captured service personnel were released. It was only then that the full extent of the second conflict became apparent. After the camps were closed, 21 American soldiers chose to remain in communist Korea, openly denouncing their own country and siding with an enemy that had killed more than 30,000 of their comrades. In addition, a surprisingly large number of the American service personnel who did return home enthusiastically expounded the strengths of communism. The family and friends of the servicemen who chose to remain in Korea were stunned, with one set of parents telling Time magazine, "I won't believe anything except that my boy wants to return home." The world's media flocked to Korea to report the story and asked psychologists to explain the soldiers' seemingly incomprehensible decision. Some researchers suggested that the Koreans had brainwashed the American soldiers with flashing lights and white noise. Others speculated that they had used advanced forms of hypnosis or mind-altering drugs. They were all wrong. Understanding exactly what actually happened to the American soldiers reveals how the as-if principle can be used to change the world. Our journey begins by venturing deep into the psychology of persuasion. When I read about the evils of drinking, I gave up reading. Footnote. Attributed to comedian Henry Youngman. End footnote. Governments spend large sums of money trying to persuade the public to stop smoking, avoid excessive drinking, and eat a healthier diet. These well-meaning campaigns often rest on one assumption. Tell people that their lifestyle is bad for them, and they will soon change their ways. Let the public know, for instance, that smoking causes cancer, and they will stop lighting up. Show them how alcoholism ruins lives, and they will curb their drinking. Point out how fatty foods clog up the arteries, and they will start eating more fresh fruit. There is, however, one small problem with this sensible approach. Much of the time, it doesn't work. Irish stand-up comedian Andrew Maxwell recently made a television program in which he went on a road trip with five people who firmly believed in various 9/11 conspiracy theories. One of the believers, Rodney, was certain that the Twin Towers were not destroyed by two hijacked airplanes, but instead collapsed because of a government-controlled explosion. Another member of the group, Charlotte, was equally sure that terrorists with such a limited amount of training wouldn't have been able to fly the planes into the Twin Towers. Maxwell took Rodney and Charlotte to meet several experts who presented overwhelming evidence against their cherished theories. In one sequence, a demolition specialist showed just how difficult it would be to prepare charges to bring down buildings the size of the Twin Towers. In another instance, a flight instructor demonstrated how easy it is to pilot aircraft. Did these experiences change Rodney and Charlotte's beliefs? Not at all. At the end of the program, Rodney and Charlotte remained unmoved by the evidence and explained that they continued to believe that the events of 9/11 were the work of the American government. Similarly, in 1997, members of the Heaven's Gate cult convinced themselves that they would soon be transported away from Earth on a spaceship traveling behind the Hale-Bopp comet. A few weeks before the comet was due to come close to the Earth, some of the Heaven's Gate members went to a shop that sold scientific apparatus and purchased a sophisticated telescope. When the group looked through the high-powered lens, they could clearly see the comet, but not the spacecraft. It would be reasonable to think that the experience might have caused the group to question their beliefs. Instead, they returned to the shop the following day, explained that the telescope was faulty, and asked for their money back. It would be nice to think that when it comes to the rocky relationship between evidence and belief, there is something rather special about Rodney, Charlotte, and the saucer-seeking members of the Heaven's Gate cult. Nice, but wrong. Although very few people think that the American government destroyed the Twin Towers or that spaceships lurk behind comets, we all hold other beliefs with similar levels of conviction. And when maintaining these beliefs in the face of disconfirming evidence, we are all capable of performing the type of mental gymnastics that conspiracy theorists and cult members display. Like them, we seek out the company of like-minded souls, avoid information that doesn't support our point of view, and question the integrity of those who dare to disagree with us. Despite our desire to be creatures of logic, we all find it surprisingly easy to ignore the facts if the facts don't fit our beliefs. One study, for example, tracked the public reaction to a comprehensive scientific report pointing out the strong link between smoking and cancer. An impressive 90% of non-smokers, compared to just 60% of smokers, said that they found the report convincing. In another study, participants were first asked to say whether they were for or against an important issue, such as climate change. Then everyone was presented with various arguments about the topic, with some of the arguments being especially plausible. Climate change is most probably due to the greenhouse effect, while others were extremely implausible. Large numbers of scientists have been bribed to say that climate change is a reality. The participants were asked to read each of the arguments and remember as many as possible. If they were rational human beings, they should have remembered a mixture of plausible and implausible arguments. In fact, a clear pattern emerged, with those on both sides of the debate remembering the plausible arguments that supported their own position and the implausible ones against it. This "I have made up my mind, don't confuse me with the facts" approach creates a major hurdle for governments wanting to change hearts and minds. Print "smoking kills" in big black letters on packets of cigarettes, and smokers will still find a way of convincing themselves that lighting up can't be all that bad. Tell heavy drinkers about the horrors of alcoholism, and they will continue to believe that they will be fine. Run a campaign about the importance of healthy eating, and the obese will still scarf up impressive quantities of burgers and fries. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. On saying and doing. Psychologists have spent decades investigating the relationship between how people say they will behave and how they actually behave, not least the work of Leonard Bickman and his colleagues from Smith College in Massachusetts. Bickman wanted to discover the connection between people's beliefs and behavior with something as simple as littering. He and his team found a busy main street and strategically placed crumpled up pieces of paper several feet away from a trash can, ensuring that the paper was in the direct path of pedestrians. Next, the experimenters moved across the street and secretly recorded the percentage of pedestrians who picked up the litter and placed it in the bin. It turned out that the good folk of Massachusetts weren't too tidy, with only 2% of pedestrians picking up the paper and putting it in the bin. In the next phase of the study, the experimenters stopped hundreds of the pedestrians after they'd walked past the litter and asked them one question. Should it be everyone's responsibility to pick up litter when they see it? Or should it be left for the people whose job it is to pick it up? What percentage of the pedestrians said that everyone should do their bit to keep the streets clean? 10%? 40%? 60%?